Well, the world is a dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And I gotta say, things have been a little weird for me lately. I know I've said that a couple of times. This season's been a real roller coaster so far. I mean that both literally and, I guess literally. But in both senses of the word, the actual season of spring and the season of the show, because the both, what the hell am I doing? See what I mean? Things are strange, and I'm beating myself up about just about everything lately, and I'm not really sure why. I have this tendency to get on myself for not being good enough or smart enough or figuring things out quickly or having enough patience immediately in the moment. And I tear myself down pretty easily. And I wouldn't tolerate that from another human being. And I don't really tolerate it when I see the people around me doing it. You know, don't talk to yourself like that. Why would you? Why would you talk to yourself like that? The language that you use in everyday conversation, when you're talking to yourself about yourself, has the power to change your perception of the things that are going on around you. I know that. I feel it. I've lived it. I've spent a lot of time rewiring the negative pathways in my brain to function better because I knew that it mattered. And every once in a while, I still catch myself in a side street or an alley where it's like, what the hell is wrong with you? And then I got to pull myself out. You know, you have almost this bubble around you. And inside that bubble, you carry all of your baggage, all of your beliefs, all of your thoughts, your personality, and it's all wrapped around you, almost like a suit of armor. Especially if you're an introvert like me, it's all around you. And it colors your perception of everything that you see. So when you take some of that bad wiring out, and some of that baggage is now gone, you can start to see other things that you weren't even aware were there a lot more clearly. You know, it's like suffering from a chronic pain. That when it's a dull, low-level pain, you walk around with it. You live with it. That's just how life is for you. You don't even notice that it's there. And then the moment that chronic pain is gone, you realize what you were living with. It almost throws you off. It can throw you off balance because you've lived a certain way for such a long time. You spent such a long time thinking certain things matter. And do they? Maybe. But maybe they don't matter in the way that you think they do. And the way that you talk to yourself about how those things matter, what those things actually mean to you, can really drive home how you feel about yourself and what needs to be changed within yourself. Now, speaking of change and self-actualized change, today on the show, we have got Meg McCabe, and she is the creator of the Baby Got Back blog. If you go to babygotbackblog.com, you can check that out. She is a eating disorder survivor, as well as a former model and a life coach, I mean, so many other things, a public speaker, a storyteller, and we really get into it. This is a pretty intense story. I don't think I got to give any sort of trigger warnings or anything, but we actually have a really wonderful conversation over a pipe and hot cup of coffee. And I think you're going to love it just as much as I loved it. There's a lot of really great insights in here. And honestly, you should go check out our blog because there's a lot of stuff there if you're a person who's looking to start putting some things in order and you don't really know where to start. Start somewhere. Try something. It's always better than nothing. Now, before the episode rolls out this week, I did want to address something. I've been kind of stuck in a hole lately. I know I haven't been updating the website. I know I haven't been replying to the messages the way that I should be. The couple of people who who had to pull me out of my shell and call me out on it. Honestly, I really appreciate it, and I'm so grateful that that you even took the time to shake me out of the funk that I was in. Because quite frankly, it's kind of unacceptable, at least on my end. You know, there are times when I'm not sure what to do or what to say. And especially when you get in your own head about not being valuable, you don't think that you're valuable to other people. If you're in somebody's life, it's usually by choice. And so you shouldn't take that for granted. And I'll tell you right now that I don't. I appreciate every one of you. Now let's talk to Meg McCabe.
I can have coffee at any time of the day.
Yeah?
Even at like 3 a.m.
Oh, man. You are so lucky. I mean, I can too, but then I'm just weird. And it's.
I don't know why. It doesn't really affect me too much. Yeah? I just like the warmth of it.
Yeah. You know what it is? There's a specific genetic thing where you are either predisposed to have a sensitivity to mm-hmm. caffeine or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you must be one of those lucky people who just doesn't have the sensitivity and you get to just like it because it smells nice and
yes,
it's hot
exactly.
and it tastes good.
That so is exactly good. My luck right there.
That is.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So how are you? What's happening in your world?
I'm doing good. I'm busy with the eating disorder recovery coaching. I've been recently certified in mental health first aid, which is a really new, exciting part of my life. And
yeah,
just been really busy. I'm so passionate about kind of getting my story out there and
yeah.
helping my clients and other people who might be struggling. So,
well, let's start here because you have a really fascinating story. But let's take it backwards.
Yeah, sure.
All the way to, you know, where are you from?
I am from a little town called Farmington, Connecticut. I like to call it Charmington.
Yeah, I bet.
Think of your typical suburbia, Connecticut experience. I don't know, you've probably seen it in the movies. It's kind of a lot like where I'm from.
Yeah, I mean, Connecticut is... Oh, boy. I mean, it's, anytime you're watching a movie where you see someone in a sweater next to fall leaves, it's probably Connecticut.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Connecticut definitely has, like, a big dose of preppiness.
Yeah.
And that, but it also has a lot of economic diversity where it's like mm-hmm. you'll be driving through Hartford and you'll see these beautiful stone mansions and then just a really dilapidated town front. Yeah.
So. Yeah. I mean, there's a real dichotomy happening there,
mm-hmm.
but,
mm-hmm.
but it is one of the great, East Coast places. I mean, they all have their own sort of flavor.
They do.
I know that you are actually, sort of a Bostonite as well.
I am a Bostonite. I'm a New Yorker. I feel like I'm from Connecticut, New York, and Boston. If people ask me where I'm from, I switch around.
Yeah, depending.
Yeah, depending on, like, what I'm thinking about. Or I'm really from Connecticut. I grew up there. I lived in New York City for, I mean, I've lived in New York City twice, and both times it kind of chewed me up and spit me out. And then,
as it does.
And then I run to safer places like Boston, and I was recently
safer
there.
Safer places like Boston.
When I say safe, I mean I feel the most safe in New York, like as in physical space. I think it's more safe as in financially secure and emotionally secure.
Yeah. Because Boston's rough.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Like, yeah. I used to play in a band that toured around, and so I got to go to a lot of places.
Oh, cool.
And so Boston was definitely, I mean, man, I have so many great stories about Boston.
Boston has its own personality. There's a lot of hubris in Boston. Mm-hmm. Everyone from Boston wants you to know they're from there.
Yep.
But the music scene, I loved the music scene there, because I felt like all the big shows would start, you know, their weekend in New York City, and then they'd make their way to Boston on, like, a Tuesday, and I'd end up in the front row.
Yeah.
You know, so I always had so much fun there with that.
That's really great. So so when did you move to Boston?
I moved to Boston when I was about 25, 26.
Yeah, so this was later.
Yeah, it was a little later. And it was really needed because I had depleted, like, all of my money in New York. I moved to New York without a job. Just this dream, this glimmer in my eye that I would be this full-time life coach. It was a very elusive idea. My parents begged me not to move to New York, and I was like, I'm going to make it. So I, because everyone tells you, go big or go home. Like, you got to be fully invested into your dreams. So I kind of drank that Kool-Aid, and I moved to New York with no plan at all.
Yeah.
Burned through my money in, like, I'm so mad about that. And then I was like, well, I got to tuck my tail between my legs and move in Boston because they'll actually hire me.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So going back even, what kind of kid were you?
Well,
like, were you always a super ambitious?
Question. I love that question. When I think about myself as a kid, I cared a lot. I was a very compassionate kid. Mm-hmm. I think I was very loving. There's, like, this home video of me in preschool with my preschool teacher, and I was, like, fixing her necklace because I loved her so much. Like, I was just always super caring and loving, and I think probably overly loving, you know, to the point where, like, you put others before you.
Yeah.
And then when I grew up, it developed into kind of like a perfectionist, overachieving, people-pleasing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that hits me right where I live. I mean, I was definitely that way too. You know, mm-hmm. just almost like a raw nerve of joy.
Yeah.
You know, except for when I wasn't. You know, because the difference with me was that you know, I'm bipolar, and so, you know, it could really be anything at any given time, but but I was super into trying to make sure everybody was happy and all of that, even when I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have an identical twin.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So that
How do you think that plays into things?
Oh, I think it played into so much. You know, I think we fed off of each other, especially with the eating disorder, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. Like, there was a lot of comparing of each other's bodies. And thankfully, we look so alike that it wasn't this thing where, oh, so-and-so is the pretty twin or so-and-so is the hot twin. You know, in high school, they can be so brutal.
Yeah.
But it also played into the fact that I was never alone. So the weird thing is I never had alone time growing up.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of kids develop, like, their own personality and their own interests. And I didn't have my own room until I was, like, 21.
Wow.
And I remember sitting in this single room at UConn where I went to school being like, what is this I have here? I have no one to talk to. I have, you know, I can explore my own self now. So yeah. That was really unique too, being a twin, because you don't really get alone time until you're an adult.
Yeah. Well, and the thing that I notice about that is that it seems like people will tend to treat twins like a unit, like yes. almost like oh. a, almost like an individual with two bodies.
Yes. Oh, that we were always treated that way.
Yeah.
And it was really detrimental growing up. I remember our Girl Scout troop leader gave mm-hmm. us badges, like gave everyone badges they had all earned, and they ran out. So they made me and Katie share a badge. Like, it's like we both earned our own badge. Like, and we, you know, we were always the McCabes. You know, people couldn't, if they couldn't tell us apart, they'd either say McCabe, you know, or yeah. or they would go, or they wouldn't say anything to us. I think people avoid conversations with twins. I know yeah. I'm guilty of it. If I can't tell twins apart and I don't want to mess up their name, right. I'll just avoid talking to them all together.
Yeah. Best to just...
Just know, like
call it good.
Just be like, you know, that comment I wanted to make wasn't that important. I'll just skip it.
Well, yeah, because at least if you don't go over there and talk to them, you know they're not alone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They have a permanent buddy.
So that's really got to do a number on your personal identity as a human being. I mean, because if you think about it, most kids who have siblings, when they're growing up, they're going to have, you know, an age gap. Mm-hmm. Or you know, personality differences. I mean, hell, they at least look different. And so it really is a matter of starting, because your personalities are developing independently. Mm-hmm. But when your personalities are developing at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and you're literally being fed the same things
yeah.
day after day, and then you don't get your own room until, you know, you're well into your adulthood. I mean, that has to have some kind of psychological effect as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not necessarily negative, but I mean, it has to play into several aspects of your personality as a human being.
Oh,
how could it not?
It definitely does. It's so interesting to hold a microscope up to it and really think about, like, how did it impact me?
Yeah.
And... you know, it's funny now because my sister and I are very different in a lot of ways. Like the second we parted ways in college,
yeah,
we became almost, I wouldn't say opposites, but I mean, I went into the nonprofit field. I was helping people. I made no money. My sister does tech sales for Microsoft. So like, think about how that our lives diverged so fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to really suddenly come into, I am going to be this kind of person. Like just embracing these new ideas, just hitting you.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine something like that. See, it's like I've got siblings, but I mean, they're all different than
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually kind of don't really even talk to them anymore. It's just sort of went that way.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no hard feelings or anything like that. But it's just, you know, we became so different and we didn't really have a lot in common growing up because we were all doing different stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I talk to people who have siblings that they're close with and I'm always fascinated by that. So I'm like, what's that like?
It is so nice. Like the older I get, the more I want to be around her. I visited her 2 weekends ago and I felt like I wanted to cry leaving her.
Huh.
Because I miss her a lot now. I think we're both living very different lives and we're realizing we might never, you know, we both recently moved in with significant others and we're mm-hmm. realizing we both might never be in the same city again or even be roommates or anything. It's just kind of weird.
Yeah. I'm just picturing the idea of, you know, giving someone a hug to say goodbye and you pull away and there's your face.
I was just writing about this today, actually, because in middle school, when we were like very lanky and awkward, we had lots of acne and these big thick bangs across our faces. We did not like seeing each other.
Yeah.
Because it was a reminder of how like awkward and ugly we were. So imagine, like in middle school, like when you look in the mirror, how you might, especially if you're a girl, you might like beat yourself up, like, I'm not pretty, I'm not cool.
I was raised by my sister, so I had that.
Probably a lot of people have this.
Yeah.
But imagine having that mirror in every class with you. Like, we wouldn't want to sit next to each other because we were so embarrassed.
Oh my God! Yeah, of course you were in class together because you're.
So we were so embarrassed by even just looking at each other because we would have that negative self-talk.
Yeah.
That's how I look.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I am like. We would be embarrassed by each other's behaviors. We didn't want to be partners with each other in like gym class because it was just like externalized low self-esteem.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So was that, was the relationship sort of strained in some ways in that time period, or were you always sort of with each other, but publicly it was like you just wanted a separation for other people's sake?
It was, we loved each other always, but I think we really felt like socially unaccepted by the hierarchy at school.
Yeah.
And so we kind of took out our anger on that on each other. So we didn't necessarily, we got along, but we would regretfully hang out together in public.
So basically, I mean, that's definitely like siblings.
Yeah.
That's standard practice. So when did you first get the idea that you wanted to take off and go to New York? What was that first trip there like?
Yeah, so the first trip to New York, I was always fascinated with the city. I'm still, like, very pulled into that city.
Yeah.
The first time was because I had, you know, this awkward, I was awkward and gangly, but that translates to, hey, you could be a model. Like, you're very skinny and, like, lanky and a foot taller than everyone else. So how about you try? So it turned into this need to join the fashion world. And so I started visiting with agents and going and eventually getting signed. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was visiting New York my whole life just because I was so close there in Connecticut. But then the first time I moved there and lived there, I was 17. I didn't go to college right away.
Yeah.
And I was living in a model's apartment with 9 other girls in Union Square, which is a really cool part of the city. But imagine nine women.
Like no food and chain smoking.
Oh
my god!
It was so. This was so funny to me because it was so interesting. There was like a foreigner side of the apartment and an American girl side of the apartment.
Oh, weird.
So it was like all the girls from Brazil and Russia, and they were all partying and smoking, and then the American girls, we were all these like kind of goody goodies who hadn't been tainted yet. Like
from Connecticut.
yeah. Like my roommate was from Nebraska. We had one from Dallas.
Of course.
And then of course then the goody goody Polish girl got stuck with us.
Mm-hmm. You're no fun. Go over here.
Exactly. But so that was, and there wasn't a lot of food. I mean, the model apartment was, it was interesting because we all knew food was a tricky subject.
Yeah.
So some of us, we all had different food rituals and forms of disordered eating.
Of course.
So I was just blatant bulimia.
Yeah?
I had bulimia during that time. So I don't know if they knew that, mm-hmm. but I would definitely stand in front of the cabinet of, like, the food pantry of my food that I had mm-hmm. and just stand in front of that thing, binge. I call it a food blackout because I feel like I would black out in front of the cabinet and eat everything in sight because my body was in starvation mode.
Right.
So my body like hijacked my brain and was like, I'm taking over now. Forget diet culture. Forget your eating. Forget restricting. Like you need to eat. So I stand in front of the cabinet and just black out. And then unfortunately purge it all after.
Yeah.
And then some girls, I mean, one woman, she must, I don't remember where she was from, but she would eat very little. She would eat an apple and cut it into cubes and then put it in a cup and then eat it with a fork. So she was trying to, like, prolong the eating experience. And I was like, huh? Like, it was just so strange to watch everyone. And
yeah.
It's
such deliberate action.
It is.
You know, you go through that process. I mean, you mentioned the rituals, and that's totally what it is.
It's
turning it, especially if it's a disorder.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to start finding rules for what you're doing. Because when you have rules, you feel like you're maintaining it
mm-hmm.
properly.
Mm-hmm.
Just like anything else, you know, like people who are like, okay, I can have 4 glasses of wine and I can only do it on Saturdays. And if I do it on Saturdays and then I have 2 glasses of wine on Mondays because it's Monday, you know, if I'm doing it this way and I'm occasionally having whiskey, but if I only do whiskey on Thursdays and it's only this much, then I'm not an alcoholic and I'm managing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's that whole thing, you know, like the friends that I have that had issues with drugs, a lot of it was the same thing too,
mm-hmm.
because it's that sort of telling yourself what the plan is.
Uh-huh.
And as long as you go with the plan, you can make a big mistake if you know what you're going to do after you've made the mistake. Like, this is
okay.
how I'm going to correct it.
Yep.
So like with you, you know, your food blackout, you know, I'm just going to eat until I feel so bad about it. I've got to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know you're going to get rid of it. That's your plan.
That is the plan, yeah.
You're not deviating from the plan, and it's working.
It was.
So you don't have to stop.
Exactly. And that I think that's those rules. Like, I know people with eating disorders, a lot of them, it provides safety. It
yeah.
provides a sense of control. And then when it does go awry and the plan doesn't work out, if there is no nothing in place, people will be even harder on themselves. And I find that, like, with dieting too. So there is a very fine line. And sometimes I think dieting can turn to disordered eating so quickly, like with your diet. Like, I'm going to eat low carb, like X number of calories, this much. And then if you slip on your diet, you're going to punish yourself
yes.
by binge eating or going to the other extreme.
Right. I've already made a mistake. Let's blow this day out of the
yes,
water.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm now, sure. Do you think that do you think that the bulimia came after the modeling, or do you think it was something that was kind of bubbling under the surface beforehand?
Good question. I think they were very tied together. The modeling was what gave me a sense of my body needs to change. Like, my body needs to be smaller. How do I make my body smaller? Let's cut
yeah.
out all these food groups. And it basically turned into, I don't want any food.
Yeah. You start seeing it as the enemy.
Oh, exactly. The food caused so much inner disgrace and turmoil and guilt.
Yes.
Which I'm so thankful I'm not going through that. I feel very bad for chronic dieters and people with eating disorders because it takes up so much brain space.
Yeah.
And it's something so small. Like, you're counting calories all day. You could be thinking about how to change the world, you know? So it's different in that way.
Yeah. I think that there was always maybe just a little something in my family. I mean, my sister, I remember, was bulimic.
Mm.
And that was particularly strange for me to watch. You know, because I was a little kid. I didn't quite get it. You know, she was a teenager. And so I can kind of remember that it wasn't super, you know, it's, I have to be careful how I say things because, you know, it's, one of my favorite phrases, and I say it on this show a lot because things come up a lot, but it's, you know, it's not really a matter of how your parents are going to fuck you up. It's, it's how, because they will. You know, all parents, they do their best.
Exactly.
You know, maybe not all parents, but I feel like most parents do their best and, you know, they think they're helping,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so But you never know what your kids are going to remember. And I do remember, you know, I do remember my mom saying something one time to my sister, like, well, what's the point in you even eating that? Because you know you're just going to throw it up anyway.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
I'm pretty sure she thought, you know, I'm trying to be sensible here.
Yeah. And that's when it's interesting because it's so out in the open. Like, yeah. The whole family knew about it.
Yeah, we all knew.
Wow, I mean, mine was very secretive.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We were only secretive about other things. I mean, you know, very, you know, sort of Catholic Lutheran upbringing. So mm-hmm. There was lots of shame and things. And so there was a lot of that. But you know, certain things, you know, just came right through. Very blunt about a lot of things. But I had a little bit of a different experience with it myself. Mm-hmm. I mean, my whole idea was, I don't know where I got this from. Maybe from the same place my sister got it, now that I think about it. But I had this idea that if I just treated food like a utility, mm-hmm. And tried not to enjoy it too much, I wouldn't abuse it. And so I treated everything in my life that way. Like,
yeah.
I'm just going to find out what works calorically, and I'm not even going to think about it. I'm going to eat the same thing every day. And, you know, like clockwork. And it mm-hmm. was, and it was stuff that, you know, drove people insane. Like, I would eat, especially since I was playing a lot of music and things like that. So, I mean, it was basically just high protein and vegetables and that's it. And like, I didn't mess with anything else. And, you know, I could go crazy and eat a pizza, like a whole pizza, but I could afford it because I was blowing so many calories just playing drums all day long, all that. And then I could regret it and go, okay, don't do that again. Pizza's great. Stay away from it. And I just had some of that.
Do not enjoy pizza.
Yeah. And then I developed something much more healthy later, like, which was, okay, you know, starting to actually have a normal relationship mm-hmm. with food. But, you know, I would see people who would go through like a real legit eating disorder. You know, and I just had paranoia and panic, but I mean, I had that about everything. So
yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't something that was super exclusive for me. Mm-hmm. But then I see people going through something like that, and I can only imagine the hell that is.
It's extreme hell. It is. If we're thinking about my personality and how the eating disorder was kind of predetermined or rooted in upbringing, mm-hmm. I think my sense of bulimia came because I constantly wanted, I wasn't about the binge. Mm-hmm. I was about the purge. And yes. I'm realizing this now as an adult. I call it recovery 2.0. I was all about the relief.
That's fascinating.
So for me, I'm realizing in my life, like, where am I constantly seeking relief in, like, because one reason why I jumped from city to city, I call it figurative binges now, or figurative purging.
Okay.
Because I'm purging a city, I'm purging a relationship, I'm purging a job. And so when I was young, I think that pattern came in. I was stuck. I wanted out of my situation. I was bored at school. I wanted a different life. So that manifested in purging in a way. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think it does. So, but the first time you decide, this is what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the thought process behind going from, you know, just being a person, mm-hmm. You know, who lived a life and does things and has a sister, and now you're here and you're by yourself and you're doing this stuff. And then there had to have been a part of your brain, and I don't mean to put that on you.
Yeah,
so
let me
rephrase that. Let's say, it seems almost like there would be a part of your brain that's telling you this is danger. Mm-hmm. Like what you're about to do here is danger.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like how does that thought skip past into this is what we do now?
Very good question, and I'm glad you asked it. I always knew, you know, I was in health class growing up. They had a video about a girl who had bulimia who hid her vomit in jars and hid them under the, you know, and I was like, is the grossest thing I've ever seen. Like, who in their right mind would do that?
Right.
So you have that logic, you know, it's dangerous. But for me, the emotions attached to food and eating were so painful. And having the food, the fear of being fat. So there's this huge thing behind eating disorders and dieting. Fat phobia is what is the term. And so I was just afraid. My fears of gaining weight and my fear of food made me justify that it was okay. Because I wanted to get rid of those feelings. I think it was like, I really just want to release these feelings somehow and stop the negative thought process and the obsession. So that was definitely it. And it wasn't really a conscious decision to purge the first time. I wanted to have this modeling contract so bad. I knew that it was connected to that.
Yeah.
And I also, and this is something strange, I never actively made myself throw up. My mind-body connection was so strong, I would get nauseous and the food would just come up. It would just come out. I would bend over and it would all just, and that might be TMI, but it was, I never like actively was gagging myself. Yeah. It was just my body was, and my brain pushed it all out.
You really made a decision.
Yeah, it was so, So I remembered purging for the first time and just thinking, oh, this isn't, I'm not really sick. This isn't a big deal. This is an ends to a means. This is me heading towards that modeling contract. I'm going to only one time. What's the big deal?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became part of your life.
Yes. And then it almost becomes automatic. Like almost after every time you eat, for me at least, it was, okay, I feel nauseous. I can potentially purge now.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you would tell yourself, like because I'm really interested in the kind of self-talk that you would have around something like this, because there would have to be some self-talk on the front end of it, but also some self-talk on the back end of it.
Yep.
So I mean, what's going through your head when you're in that state?
You know, when I was that young, I wasn't even really aware of what self-talk was. So I think what I can almost assume was going on in my head was, this is not good. I should not be eating this. This food is bad. This is this many calories. This is too much food. It was just intense diet culture talk in my ear the whole time. And that led to the negative emotions, because those thoughts led to emotions like guilt and shame, which led to the behavior.
Yeah.
And then after I would engage, I just kind of would go throughout my life like nothing happened. I don't think I had a lot of self-awareness during this time of my life.
So afterward,
I don't think I did.
You would just be kind of like, oh, good. So I can be relieved now.
Yeah. Yeah, I would just be like, okay, like, I knew that was going to happen. Let me just move on with my life. You know, I didn't want to think about it too much.
No, but I don't think that people talk about that part of it very often, you know? I mean, you hear people discuss bulimia and, I mean, you know, you grow up with it. Like you said, health class, we're all taught the dangers of these things and the pressure that's put on girls when they're young and even into adulthood as women. And you see it still pervasive to this day.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's almost like they're telling you with a wink, you know, like, well, you know, some people do this. You shouldn't, but, you know, wink, wink. You know.
I know. It is. It's like we really can't win.
Yeah.
It's like stay fed, but be small. eat healthy, but enjoy food.
Yeah,
there's a lot exactly. of, there are a lot of rules. And it's funny you say the wink, wink thing, because I feel like so many, when I'm open about my story, I have so many people come up to me and be like, you know, I was bulimic too. I think it's something people are ashamed to talk about. And I'm lucky because talking about it was never a shameful thing, I think, for me.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
But that's also why I'm so grateful for you to be here and talk to me about it, because I think that like I said, the bits and pieces beyond the larger issue, you know, putting a human face to it and actually being able to, you know, get some understanding of what it's like to be a person in the situation mm-hmm. versus talking about it like, you know, here's this sickness that some people have, you know, it's, you know, don't be a person with a sickness. And that's as far as it goes. I think people don't really talk about their experiences with things like this too often, at least not with, you know, a great amount of detail. And I think that details can help.
Oh, I think so,
because people start connecting to details.
Yep.
Like when I hear people talking about, you know, their relationship to their bipolar, like what I have, I'm like, yes, absolutely. I can relate to this. Okay, so there are other people. I got it. All right, I'm not the only person who's taken a washing machine apart at 3 a.m. that had nothing wrong with it because mm-hmm. I was in a mania.
Yeah. Yeah, just sometimes saying it all without the details is helpful for people. Like you saying, yeah. I have bipolar, you are brave, more brave than the people who sit there and don't say anything. Or not.
It's helpful.
It's helpful because then I'm not alone. But then to go into the details of your bipolar is where people really relate. And they're like, oh my God, I need to hear this guy's story. Like, this makes me feel really okay.
Yeah. I think that that's part of it. And another part of it, too, is sometimes you'll be telling your story and it'll inspire people to tell theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, while they'll say, you know, I never took a washing machine apart, but I did wake my kids up at 3 a.m. To go look at a boat, you know, and then by the time we got there, the mania had worn off and I just felt sad, you know, and there are people out there with those stories. And when we start talking to each other about the various specifics, sometimes it can get really funny.
It can. Because it actually can.
Because sometimes it's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, and it's so hard because the eating disorder space has such a tone of seriousness.
Yeah.
And eating disorder recovery and healing, like, if you look online, all the therapists have these, like, very soothing websites. You know what I'm saying? And, like, I just feel like we could bring a little humor into the concept without minimizing it.
Sure.
But, like, bring a little humor into the fact that you're eating less calories than an infant needs.
Yes.
You know, there are some things that can, there is some humor there.
Well, and that's, so did you ever go the route of, or did you know anybody, especially living in, you know, this model commune?
Yeah.
Like, did you know people that ate baby food?
I did not know anyone that ate baby food.
Because I knew some people that ate baby food. Like, they made a decision, like,
as a diet? Like,
yeah, as a diet. That's what they were going to do, was eat baby food.
That is so sad to me. That is so sad.
Yeah. That's like adult people doing that. But it is kind of funny, like, in hindsight, because the person I know got over it. But, you know, it's one of those things where I understand why these websites have, you know, a certain tone, and mm-hmm. and even therapists and office buildings and things like that. I mean, of course they have a certain tone, because chances are you're catching somebody at a time when they're pretty vulnerable. And the very first impression you make with somebody who is tentatively stepping forward for help,
mm-hmm.
you probably don't want to scare them off with a joke.
It's true. And that's the sad thing. I think humor is so healing, and fun is really healing.
Yes.
I have this dream of mine where I want to bring fun into recovery. Because fun really got me out of it. If that Like, yeah, I just realized life was more fun than this. And,
yeah.
And you don't need to be obsessed over something, like, so small and so meaningless in a way. Food has meaning, but it's not supposed to take up 90% of your thoughts.
Right.
And so when I had more fun, it kind of had the eating disorder shuffle out of the picture. Like, and by that I mean I went to college and I had a relationship and I started partying and like things that made me like feel more alive than my eating disorder did or did not, you know.
So how did you come out of it? So I mean, once you found yourself in this place, what was the thing that started to bring you out?
Well, leaving the industry, quitting modeling really helped. And then what also helped was the funny thing. This was the first thing that came to mind was I was a lifeguard and we all had to run around in bathing suits all day. And I remember coming back from modeling and nobody gave shit about what my body looked like.
Right.
Like, everyone's like, oh, it's Meg. She just looks a little thicker. Like,
yeah.
Glad you're back. Let's have fun this summer. Yeah. And I think it was, like, seeing those, the external factors where your body wasn't the center focus anymore. It was more about who you are as a person.
Right. You start assigning your self-worth to yourself.
Yes, yes. My self-worth shifted. Like, I was no longer this person who depended on her body to have a successful life. If anything, my eating disorder gave me a sense of, especially the recovery, gave me a sense of, I've gotten through something.
Yeah.
Look at who I am. I was really proud of the fact that I had overcame something that large, you know, and I felt like going into school, I was like this wise old woman who had lived many lives.
Well, it takes a lot out of you to go through, the amount of effort that it takes to maintain a disorder like that and live a life.
Oh, it's. And I think there was this wisdom within me that knew it wasn't sustainable.
Yeah.
That discipline, the willpower, those rules.
Yeah.
You know, you live your whole childhood without those, and then all of a sudden they come crashing into your life, and you have this very militaristic, rigid relationship with food. Mm-hmm. And I knew deep down, this is not sustainable. Like, I need to have a nice, quick modeling career, and then this won't last. You know, if modeling goes well, I'll stick with it as long as I can, but this is impossible. And that's why diets don't work either.
Right. But it's like, I'm a matchstick. And so basically it's, you know, I just need to try to get this going for as long as the flame can burn, and then that's it.
Exactly. I think I had reached my end of the matchstick way sooner than I thought. Like, it was like, I lasted for a few years, and then all of a sudden things got really bad, and every, like, modeling went up in flames, like, I started gaining all this weight, and I was like, I need to have a new philosophy about my body. Like, I was pulling for something to save me out of that situation. So changing my, you know, there's the sense of body image. There is a difference between, like, how people in the fashion industry view bodies and then people in real life view bodies. And I think the fashion industry is so extreme that just shifting to like a more realistic version of how my body could look and understanding, you know, this is my set point. And set point is a term we use in recovery to say like your naturally occurring body shape and size. Like, if dieting didn't exist, this is how your body would be. If you were able to eat the foods you want and had a very healthy relationship with food and eating, you would land at your set point or within a set point. And I didn't know what that was called back then, but I kept saying, like, my body is this size, but it really wants to be this size. Like, yeah. I was referring to the set point.
Just putting yourself in a box for the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I knew it was outside of that modeling set point range. Yeah. And so I have this wisdom, too, during, I keep using the word wisdom, but I had this knowledge during recovery, too, and a sense of body trust that my body wasn't going to uncontrollably gain weight when I started eating, because I think a lot of my clients have a fear that when they start eating again and feeding themselves, they won't be able to stop, and they're going to uncontrollably gain and gain and gain, and it's just going to be the other end of the, you know, the pendulum swing.
Yeah.
But I have this, like, awareness that my body is just trying to restore itself. It's just trying to get back to where it was in the beginning, you know, where I went when I had a good relationship with food. So that helped me not be so afraid to proceed with recovery and eating again and holding down my food.
It sounds like you had some good people in your corner, too.
Oh, yeah, I definitely did. I kept my eating disorder secret for a very long time. Me and my sister kind of had an idea, but we didn't talk about it. And when I finally quit modeling was when I kind of came out out of the eating disorder closet. And
sure.
I was like, Mom, like, you know, I kind of told her we beat around the bush, like Irish Catholic family.
Yes.
Like we were.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we kind of beat around. But she understood. She saw that I was.
Swallow your shame, girl.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So she put me in therapy with an eating disorder specialist. And then I did see a dietitian for a little bit,
but
who
that's
I
good.
Hated.
Well, that could also
people
be
with
good.
Eating disorders usually do not like their dietitian at first.
Of course not.
So, but yeah, that was really helpful. Mm-hmm. It was extremely helpful, and but it was funny, and I always find this to be a unique part of the story. The first person I really verbalized my eating disorder to and called it what it was, like I have bulimia, was not anybody I was close to. It was some random coworker. I was a hostess at a steakhouse, and we were folding napkins and cleaning menus, and I was like, I have bulimia. Like, it just kind of, like, came out, and I was like, she was really accepting and loving about it, and then that gave me the courage to start telling the people that mattered to me, you know, the people I really cared about my story and knew could help me. It was like a little practice run.
That's not uncommon.
Yeah.
If you'll forgive the term, but to just barf that on some random person, you know?
Yeah.
Because I remember that was totally how I was when I first decided to tell somebody I'm suicidal. It was not anyone I was close with. It was just some other kid. And he was like, that's weird. You know?
Yeah, well, he's like, but, I don't know why'd you tell me this. Like, I don't know
what we're doing. can we just go back to Transformers? Like, this is not all right, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, but that's what you do. And then when you finally figure out how you're going to say it, it's a lot easier to tell a stranger something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Weirdly, because if they judge you, they're going to go away. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, or if they don't, you can get some of that sweet, sweet acceptance that you're so desperately needing.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps break the ice for what you know you really have to do.
Exactly. I agree.
But seeing a therapist and a dietitian and, you know, any sort of professional in that regard, I always say there's a lot of value in that, even if the person is terrible, because they're giving you ideas different than the ones you already have.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you just start having those ideas bounce off of you and you go, you know, I'm not sure you're right about this, but you know what? You're making me think. And so now I have an opinion.
Yeah.
And this is where I think maybe this needs to go. And sometimes you're right. Sometimes you're not. If you have a really good person, they can give you some things that will help.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a bad person, I think they still help, sort
they
of.
They all help. I think you're right. They do offer new ideas, and it's a really good way to verbalize things and have aha moments. I feel when things are verbalized for the first time, they're a little bit more solidified in my brain. Like, they become real.
Yeah.
And so that's how therapy helped me And I also remember, because you were saying, like, they offer ideas.
Yes.
One idea that my eating disorder recovery therapist offered to me was, you know, Meg, and this sticks with me, and I tell this to my clients. I don't even know if it's true, but I've never verified it, but she told me this, and I will believe it. She was like, people don't really notice weight gain if it's less than 15% of your body weight. You know, she's like, or she said something like, people only notice about when you're gaining weight until you reach about 15% of your original weight gain. Or yeah,
something like that.
Yeah, and yeah. I was like, oh, so I could gain like over 15 pounds and nobody would notice? And I just needed to, that really sat with me, like, mm-hmm. wow, people aren't scrutinizing my body, you know, as much as I am.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough thing to come to as well as a human being. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a hard thing for me to come to. You know, I just went through a round of pretty intense depression. Mm-hmm. And over the course of that depression, I gained a bunch of weight because I wasn't doing anything and I was eating. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course I'm going to eat my feelings. And yeah. I had a good old time. And then I had to buy new clothes. And that's when I knew that, oh, yeah, I've gained a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. I also realized that because I was so depressed, I wasn't even bothering to look at myself in the mirror. And the first day that I woke up and I wasn't depressed and I looked in the mirror, I was terrified because I was like, oh no, I look like this now. But then I realized, yeah, I look like this now. Okay, so, you know, let's maybe tone it back a little bit, but not beat ourselves up while we're here. So mm-hmm. if I got to buy some new clothes, I'll buy some new clothes, and I will buy them the right size mm-hmm. so that they fit, so that I look nice at the size I'm at.
That's a really healthy perspective to have.
Well, I didn't get there real easy.
I know.
It was kicking and screaming, but I got there.
Yeah. I think, do you find that this is your ebb and flow, too, like, when you're in depression, you tend to gain. So when yeah. you come out of it, you're like, you know, this is my pattern. And I know that it will have, you know, at some point it will go down again. Mm-hmm. And then, so it's nice to have that awareness of your body patterns too. Yep. Because it helps you have that empathy for yourself when you're coming out of a depression and your right. body is different.
Yeah.
When I'm really like anxious or stressed, I'll actually lose weight due to I have a fast metabolism and yeah. like, I don't know, anxiety, who knows, but I'll lose some weight. And, for me, that's like an alert system now. Like I'll be like, I don't really weigh myself, but if I notice right. that I'm thinner, I'm like, okay, Meg, like, where's the self-care? Like, you yeah. need to, it's not like an exciting weight loss. I'm not like, yes, I'm thinner now. It's like, exactly. how is my mental health doing?
Yeah. And that's important.
Yeah.
Because it can really swing either way. I mean, you know,
yeah.
here we are, perfect polar opposite situations.
Yeah.
But, you know, both of them require you to take a look at yourself and be honest. And that's important.
I think people who, when they are, I find the outside world sees weight gain as this immediate disconnect to physical health. Like, oh, you've gained weight.
Yeah.
You are unhealthy. And they'll comment on your body in this fake, compassionate way. Like, we're concerned about your physical health.
Yes.
Like, but really, the question should be, how are you doing emotionally?
Yeah.
And I don't think people see that as much. They just are all afraid of fatness
yeah.
and want to try to control your body. So I don't know. I hope listeners recognize, like, if someone is gaining weight, first of all, you don't really want to comment on their body
right.
one way or the other. Like, if they're losing weight, I wouldn't say anything because you don't know how if they lost it in a healthy way.
But, you know, it's never a bad idea to just ask somebody, how you doing?
Yeah, exactly.
And just genuinely listen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the doctor and I was like, okay, here it comes. You know, you're over 40 and you gained all this weight and, you know, your blood pressure is probably. But they checked everything and they were like, you are healthy as a horse. There's not a thing wrong with you. You're a little overweight, but you knew that. But it's not affecting your health in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you exercise? Yeah. What's your diet like? Well, it's, you know, kind of mostly paleo sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, well, all your blood levels are good. Everything's good. So, yeah, I don't have any complaints. You're fine. Like, right where you're at, you're fine. I'm like, I don't feel fine. Well, that's on you.
I know.
And that's when it was like, okay, well, I know where I'm happy, but I need to learn to be happy here too. Mm-hmm. So I'll be happy here.
And that is that's a powerful thought. Like, how can I be happy where I am?
Yeah.
And how can I be happy with my body the way it is?
Yeah.
And you also have to think to yourself, who's telling me to be unhappy with my body?
Right, yeah.
Because chances are it's not you.
Yeah.
If you were on a desert island and no one else was there to see your body, would you still be dieting?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Question.
You would have other concerns.
you would have other questions, but it's like, you're dieting because everyone's telling you to, and you're concerned about the way people are perceiving you because people perceive, there's a lot of stigma around weight.
Sure.
There's a lot of weight stigma out there.
Sure there is. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you've come out the other side of it now, mm-hmm. and you're helping people.
I am helping people.
And that's fantastic.
Now.
So tell me a little about that. Like, how did you get involved in that?
Well, I told you a few years back, I was very inspired by the life coaching movement.
Sure.
And I wanted to, and I think I really was inspired by the sense of being an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. But I also really didn't like the vagueness of being a life coach. I just felt a little silly when I introduced myself that way. Mm-hmm. People are like, so what do you do as a life coach? And I was like, I don't really know what I do. Like, I'm a therapist who tells people to do things. You know,
yeah.
It's like, I didn't really know. So there were a few years where I was kind of playing with that idea and kind of exasperated by that idea.
Like, you knew you wanted to be involved in helping people.
Uh-huh.
But it was just sort of nebulous.
It was. It was nebulous. And then, actually, this was very interesting, and I haven't talked about it too much until recently, but when I was living in New York, there was a point, I had been recovered for probably 4 or 5 years, fully recovered.
Yeah.
But there was a point where someone made a comment about my body, and they said, you're the bigger twin now. And I was very tempted to take...
I bet that felt good.
Oh, my God. I was like, oh, my God. It just brought me back to the eating disorder thinking and, like, I need to lose weight now. And so I really seriously considered taking laxatives, which I hadn't even done in the past. But I was like, I'll just do this sneaky thing.
Right.
You know, it won't be a big deal. I just need to lose some weight. And so I bought them. You know, it was one of those things where I went to the pharmacy, like, a few times, and I'd chicken out. And then I'd go back to buy them, and then I'd chicken out. And then one time I bought them because I knew it was an eating disorder thing.
Sure.
So then I bought them. And then I remember I was about to take them, and I had this thought, like, I'm supposed to be coaching people with their lives. Like, this is my story. Like, do I really want to be... back into this, like that's where the self-awareness was finally formed, like, and I was really debating. And so
you went so far as to have a plan.
I did have a plan. And then I remember taking out my phone, and this was a tool in my recovery toolbox I did not have when I was young, mm-hmm. which was reach out to, you know, as a coach, I encourage my clients to reach out to me if they want to engage in a behavior. I started texting my mom almost like a help me.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm tempted to take laxatives and I don't want to do it. And it was really like this, you know, one part of me really did, one part of me really didn't want to. And so I decided to delete the text, and I was like, I'm going forward with this.
Yeah.
And then I accidentally sent it. And obviously, you know, it could have been an accident, but maybe it was unintentionally intentional. Anyway, long story short is that moment made me real. And I didn't take the laxatives, and I continued being a recovered person. That moment made me realize I need to have this be my specialty. I need to have this eating disorder recovery coaching be my thing. And this is my story, and I need to be proud of it. And this is how I can have a niche, you know? So that's kind of how I got into it. It was like, I was awakened in that moment.
Right.
This is what I'm meant to be doing.
Well, and, you know, you learn so many things along the way. You pick up a tool chest of ideas and thoughts and helpful things. And the thing that's good about that, and that, like the thing I've been able to do here with this, is kind of similar in the regard that I've picked up all of these bits and pieces from going through something so crazy and coming out the other side with some perspective.
Yeah.
And, you know, that might actually be able to help some people.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, what good is it if you're not? You know?
It's true. It's like, we don't want to put our knowledge to, like, waste. You've experienced all these little nuggets of wisdom and these tools, and it's so important to talk about it so you can help other people and give them the tools. It's like when people say, I wish someone told me this when I started.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like that. Exactly.
And now you're in a position where, you know, you've gone through something where you literally have the power at this point to give someone information that can really stop them from ruining their lives, or at least help them regain some of their lives and be better moving forward with information they didn't have before. And that's really helpful and really important. And I'm really glad that you came by to share this with everybody.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity and the platform to share my story and help people who are listening. I think it's such a powerful show and a message in general, just breaking down the stigma of mental health by having coffee and conversation. I think it's just brilliant. So thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for talking to me. Oh, man, talk about a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of understanding. I mean, I'm really in awe when people can pull themselves together in such an incredible way over such incredible odds. I really want to thank Meg for coming in to talk to me. You can find more at babygotbackblog.com. As for me, if you bothered to listen all the way to the end of the episode and you happen to be near Denver or Westminster, Colorado, I'll be playing drums with the band Velvet Compass at the Lodo. But until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.